This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Under law, the National Security Council is a small group of very high-level officials who advise the president. These days, NSC usually refers to the 200 or so researchers and staff who debate, execute, and coordinate U.S. foreign policy, but sometimes it's an informal group, the president's family and friends, the people he turns to for advice. David Rothkopf calls it the committee in charge of running the world. Rothkopf's new book is a history of the NSC from Truman to Bush II, a bureaucratic analysis of turf won and lost, and an insider's look at what it does and how it does it. He examines the roles of ideology and philosophy and the people behind this often faceless institution who serve at the pleasure of the president, unaccountable to Congress. Later in the program, the latest twists in the Valerie Plame case as Time magazine agrees to turn over the notes of reporter Matt Cooper and columnist Robert Novak vows to tell all. But first, if you have questions about the National Security Council, how it works and what it does and how it affects international events, give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now is David Rothkopf, author of Running the World, the Inside Story of the National Security Council and the Architects of American Power. He's with us from our offices in San Francisco. Good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
It's a pleasure to be here.
In your book, you have a game you describe as 2 degrees of Henry Kissinger. What's that?
Well, it's a way of illustrating how tight-knit the community is that actually makes U.S. foreign policy and how tight-knit it's been for a long, long time. And one way to illustrate it is to note that of the 13 national security advisors that followed Henry Kissinger in the office, and he was really the fellow who brought the office to its sort of current level of extraordinary power, all either worked with or for Henry Kissinger, or they worked with or for someone who worked with or for Henry Kissinger. And thus you can see not only the enormous influence of one man, but what a tight-knit world this is that tends to be making some of the biggest decisions of our time.
We'll talk more about that in a minute, but this 2 degrees of Henry Kissinger, that would include you.
Yes, it would. I worked as a managing director of Kissinger Associates, keeping with my desire to be a balanced centrist kind of guy, I was also a senior official in the Clinton administration. So I've worked with both sides of the track.
Well, in the Clinton administration, you were Deputy Undersecretary of Commerce for International Trade. That's a pretty fancy title.
Yeah, well, one of the things I learned in the government is the longer your title, the less power you have. And I was actually Deputy Undersecretary of Commerce for International Trade Policy Development, which is longer and even less powerful.
Well, we played a clip from Dr. Strangelove at the beginning of the program. You mentioned the movie in your book, too. You've been there. How accurate are the images that we've developed from the movies and from TV shows like The West Wing?
Well, you know, I think, first of all, you know, in terms of the physical environs, you know, you go into the Situation Room and it looks more like somebody's rec room in their basement than it does like some of these scenes you see in a movie with big screens and high key lighting and generals moving in and out of the shadows. It's a small room with a bunch of leather chairs, and it's not terribly prepossessing in any respect. The human encounters, though, I think are the things that get even shorter shrift, because so much of the decision-making process is really an interpersonal, informal, behind-the-scenes process. Much of it's shrouded in secrecy, but a lot of it's colored by personality and interpersonal dynamics, much more than it is by things like, you know, the policy that people might study in school if they were studying something like the NSC. And that misses out, you know. And there is the high drama and high comedy that you sort of you captured when you used that scene from Dr. Strangelove. But there's also a lot of low comedy and low drama and pettiness and also some inspiration and some remarkable behavior.
You use a lot of Shakespearean analogies. But getting back to this relatively small group of people who form this community, you track almost all of them back to what, not merely Ivy League, but 3 or 4 schools in the Ivy League.
Well, the reality is it's drawn from a handful of schools, and you see throughout the evolution of this kind of establishment, Those references in the very early days around Truman. We talked about the Eastern establishment, but that establishment's in place now. You know, Donald Rumsfeld, his college roommate at Princeton was Frank Carlucci, another former Secretary of Defense who was also a National Security Advisor. Anthony Lake, who was Bill Clinton's National Security Advisor, had a roommate in graduate school who was Dick Holbrooke, who later became a UN ambassador. You can go on and on. A few schools, including the military academies, play a disproportionate role in supplying the people who end up in these positions.
One of the intriguing questions you ask in your book is this a good thing or a bad thing? In a crisis, wouldn't you prefer to have a group of people who know each other extremely well and know where they're coming from?
Sure, and you would also like to have a group of people who had a lot of experience, were professionals, were dealing with these issues on the highest level for 30 or 40 years. And if you look at the current administration, you see Donald Rumsfeld, who traces his days back to the Nixon administration, who was actually Dick Cheney's boss in the Ford administration, Steve Hadley, who was a Kissinger staffer, now the National Security Advisor, but who's worked with this group for many years, Condoleezza Rice, who was a protege of Brent Scowcroft, who worked in that earlier administration. Obviously, the president is the son of the CIA director from that administration. So there's a long chain of relationships that have been in place there. But there's another side of it. And the other side of it is that inbred groups tend to start developing groupthink. And there's a conventional wisdom and creative thinking tends to be constrained by that. And you get kind of incremental adjustments in U.S. policy and not really revolutionary breakthroughs or the kind of fluidity or flexibility you might want to see in rapidly changing times, such as the times that we're living in now.
And you describe an important change by examining the National Security Council under Brent Scowcroft in the Bush 1 administration or Bush 41 administration and the National Security Council under Condoleezza Rice in the first George W. Bush administration.
Well, I think there's an important contrast there because in many respects, the administration of Bush 41 was the paradigm that people look at and say, this is how this kind of process should work. First of all, the president was extremely well-trained. Out of the past five presidents, he's the only one who came into office with a lot of national security experience. He had been the CIA director. He'd also been effectively the U.S. ambassador to China, a member of Congress. He'd also been the vice president. He knew what he wanted. He turned to Brent Scowcroft, who'd already been national security advisor once in the Ford administration, who'd been on the Tower Commission, which saw the breakdown of the NSC in the Reagan years and recommended the changes that were necessary. He had, as Secretary of State, James Baker, who had also been a White House chief of staff and a Treasury secretary who knew how the system ought to work, knew these fellows very well, and Dick Cheney, who, again, had been a White House chief of staff and knew how the system should work. So they came in with a consensus about having a system that would present the president with real options and allow him to make choices, and that would derive those options out of a kind of skeptical analytical process that is optimal, and that they would work within the context of the international system as the United States had really done since the end of the Second World War. The contrast with the administration of George H.W. Bush's son is striking. It has become much more ideological. The National Security Advisor in the first term, Condoleezza Rice, was so preoccupied with serving the president as his kind of personal staffer that she was unable to play the role of honest broker that Scowcroft did. And this allowed a shift in the balance of power within this small inner circle over to the office of the vice president, which ended up developing a national security staff which was actually larger than the national security staff that John Kennedy had when he was president, and really put the vice president in the position of being de facto national security advisor. He had this long relationship I referred to earlier with Rumsfeld, mm-hmm. and they thus had the kind of thumb on the scales in terms of the balance of decision-making. There was a lot of kind of ideological motivation in that decision-making as opposed to skeptical analysis. And so you get this contrast between the traditionalists, the internationalists like Scowcroft, and the transformationalists and the unilateralists that are sometimes associated with neocons in this administration. It's really a rather different process.
If you'd like to join our conversation with David Rothkopf, his new book is Running the World, The Inside Story of the National Security Council and the Architects of American Power. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, TOTN@NPR.org. And let's go to Gary. Gary's with us from Portland, Oregon.
Hi, how you doing?
Very well, thanks.
I just wanted to make a point or more of a question. Don't you think it's a bad thing to have all these, say, people from the old school with a one-track mind trying to shape the future and keeping their mindset in the past?
Well, I think that keeping your mindset in the past and having a one-track mind is certainly a bad thing. I have to say, in interviewing over 130 people in doing this book, people from both parties, I found for the most part the people who are in high levels in the U.S. government really are earnestly engaged in trying to serve the national interest. But I do think we could do better. I heard a conversation not too long ago in which an American business leader referred to his conversations with the Chinese leadership, and he said, you know, they're all engineers. So when I talk to them about science or I talk to them about numbers, they get it. I go to Washington, and everybody I talk to about these things are lawyers. And they don't get it. And I think we do need to break out of the boxes of policymakers if we're going to deal with the kind of next generation issues that we're going to face.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, Gary. And do you think that that groupthink is a result of, as you say, this small group, or the same advisors were drawn from the same elites in the first Bush administration, the George H.W. Bush administration, or is this a result of ideology?
Well, I think it's a result. In the end, the way any administration works is a result of what the president wants. And the first George Bush administration was guided by a man who understood how the process worked, had a lot of experience with it, and insisted on using the process to give him a range of choices that were supported by substantial professional analysis. The interesting thing is that if you take much the same group of people and put a different man at the center, in this case, a man who's guided largely by faith and intuition about what's right. And, you know, Colin Powell said to me that George W. Bush differed from his father and that the father was guided by a certain kind of an intellect, and he felt the son was guided by a kind of inertial navigation system. So he wants things that conform with his gut about what's right. And that takes a lot of the analysis out of the process. And we've seen what some of the consequences of that really are.
We'll continue our look at the ever-changing National Security Council after a short break. If you have questions about how it works, about its past or its present or its future, our number is 800-989-8255. Email us, TOTN at NPR.org. Back after the break, it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. If you've watched the West Wing, you may think you know the National Security Council, or NSC. Lots of wonkish guys and a few women plotting the course of the world. In fact, few have had a real peek at how the president's inner circle actually operates. David Rothkopf, author of Running the World, The Inside Story of the National Security Council and the Architects of American Power, is with us to explain, from the insider's perspective, how things really work. If you have questions about the NSC's history, its membership, or its effect on the world, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email TOTN at NPR.org. And let's go back to the phones. This is Chip. Chip calling from Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Yeah, hi. Thanks a lot for taking my call. I really enjoy the show.
Thank you.
I'm just curious, prior to 9/11, how much of this was domestic and how much of their duties was international as far as, you know, running the world, like the book says?
Mm-hmm.
And then after 9/11, has there been a change in focus or a change in emphasis? Are they looking more outside the borders, or are they looking more inside the borders? Because I know, you know, in the news this morning on one of the NPR stations, this interview with this guy whose name happens to be on a list. It's a very common name, and he keeps getting nabbed by the police as a suspected terrorist. And it's happened six or seven times, I think. And finally, the immigration people had to write a letter and said, yeah, you know, we know this is happening, but we don't really have any way to fix it. I'm just curious as to how the focus of the organization has changed, you know, throughout the last little while of current events.
David Rothkopf?
Well, it's an interesting question, because the reality is that when the National Security Council was formed in 1947, it was given a mandate in the act that established it, and it said it is responsible for both domestic and foreign national security interests. Over the course of the Cold War, of course, everybody's sense was that the greatest threats to our national security lay outside our borders, and so the domestic focus atrophied a bit. Domestic issues were left to other agencies that were not really in this NSC loop on a regular basis. And I think part of what happened on 9/11 was that we recognized the problem that comes when domestic issues are dealt with separately. And within the White House, the response was, let's create a new NSC-like apparatus, the Homeland Security Council, which is run by a woman now named Frances Fragos Townsend. And that was to be a parallel of the NSC. The problem, I think, with that approach is that these discussions are connected. Our national security is both foreign and domestic based. And somehow you need to have a mechanism for integrating all of that. And by breaking our national security apparatus now into a homeland piece and an international piece, we actually make the job of interagency communication, which the 9/11 Commission said was so important and so wanting, much more difficult.
But to get back to another point of Chip's, 9/11, you say in your book, and I think was part of the result of the question, I think you put it in your book that 9/11 began to transform the transformationalists.
Well, sure, because if you look at the first 9 months of the Bush administration, they were pursuing what I would characterize as a kind of a gated community foreign policy. In other words, let's put up some walls, let's keep the rest of the world out, let's deal with domestic issues. It was almost neo-isolationist, and there was a lot of concern about that prior to 9/11. As of the moment that those planes hit the towers in Manhattan, everything changed. The president realized he needed to move these issues up in importance and turned much more increasingly to Cheney, who worked in tandem with Rumsfeld to formulate a new policy for this era. The transformationalists, the neocons who saw an opportunity for the United States to advance the U.S. vision of how the world ought to look, jumped on this opportunity and used it to shape the war on terror. And a number of them who felt that Iraq was unfinished business from the first Bush administration very quickly started trying to factor that into the mix. And very early on, Iraq became factored into the mix. So this was the catalytic moment around which most of the policies that we're discussing today were actually formed. And many of the alliances that have driven those policies were also solidified as a result of that day.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call, Chip.
Thank you.
You also talk about the significance and effect. There's a shadow National Security Council that works for the vice president's office.
Well, the vice president's office has built up quite a national security staff. It's ebbed and flowed, and the vice president's office is a little sensitive to the fact that attention has been brought to it. But the reality is that in this administration, his chief of staff, Scooter Libby, has the same rank as the national security advisor. He's had a team of national security specialists around him from the beginning. They actually attend the working level meetings, the deputies meetings, the principals meetings, these several tiers of meetings that take place in the policy formation process. And as one very senior Bush administration official said to me, they get three swings at the ball. And anytime the vice president steps in and says, I'm uncomfortable with this, it's not the same as if a cabinet agency does. He's the 800-pound gorilla, and policies he's uncomfortable with don't proceed. So he has played a role that is unprecedented in U.S. history, by far the most influential vice president we've ever had.
Let's get another caller on the line. Will. Will's with us from Durham, North Carolina.
Appreciate the opportunity. I've read a lot about Robert McFarlane, and I feel that he was a brilliant strategist and an incredible analyst, and I just wonder where you think he stands in the mix. I feel he was really trying to be a voice of reason and was being less and less heard.
This back in the Reagan administration, of course.
Back in the Reagan administration. I feel that he could have been pivotal, and I just wondered what your opinion was. I'll hang up and listen.
Thanks for the call, Will.
Uh-huh. Well, McFarlane is an interesting character and in many respects a kind of a tragic character. The Reagan administration responded to the rise in power of the National Security Advisor of Kissinger and subsequently Brzezinski by reacting against it. And they demoted the office. They had the National Security Advisor report up through Ed Meese, who was one of the triumvirate that ran the White House for Reagan. They actually moved the office out of the corner office in the West Wing and down into the basement. And it drifted further and further out of the ambit of interest of the president. As a result, it began to do this freelancing, this kind of operational behavior that later became Iran-Contra and was the undoing of McFarlane and his successor, another brilliant man who ultimately has to be viewed as very unsuccessful in the job because of Iran-Contra, Admiral John Poindexter. The problem was the NSC process has to have a strong and engaged president at the middle of it to work. And Ronald Reagan didn't want to play that role. And outside of having that kind of adult supervision, guys like Ollie North were able to go out and do things that strayed beyond the barriers of the law, strayed beyond the desires of the Congress and the American people, and ultimately almost undid the Reagan presidency.
You describe an NSC that when it does too much of the Ollie North execution operational stuff, it loses its focus. When it becomes too much of an academic debating society, it loses focus.
That's right, and that's a balance that has to be struck. During the early years of the Clinton administration, one of the criticisms of the NSC was that it was, you know, too much of an academic debating society or a kind of symposium. Colin Powell was one of the people who was frustrated by this kind of aimless discussion process that he felt was not productive. And I think those two points that you bring up define kind of the constraints within which you've got to work to have an effective NSC. It's got to be focused on the job of policy formation, of pulling together intelligence and the best thinking of agencies in order to help the president make the right policy decision. And then it's got to be focused on the implementation of that, moving the execution out into the appropriate agencies that have the capability of being effectively operational. If it strays away from either of those two tasks, goes into other areas, or doesn't take either of those sufficiently seriously, it doesn't work very well.
Let's get another caller in. Chris from Rockville, Maryland. Hey, Chris, you're on the air.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay.
Yes, David's book is titled Running the World. And I was just thinking, I wonder if the U.S. and the national security apparatus are getting to the point where the world is more and more out of their control, specifically with reference to China. What would the U.S. do if China attacks Taiwan? What about China's increasing control over energy resources? Is the National Security Council focusing on this and able to do something about it? And what about our military force if we face a conflict on more than one front? Thanks.
Thanks for the call, Chris.
Well, there are several questions embedded in there. And of course, I use the term running the world a bit provocatively and a bit ironically. I think it's the most powerful committee that's ever existed in terms of its ability to project force and influence people around the world. That is for sure. But surely we don't run the world. There are limitations on our power. And I think one of the best illustrations of those limitations is, in fact, China. We look at each other both as important allies and as potential rivals. And in fact, I would sort of characterize it as two giants that are also Siamese twins, and that we are connected by arteries of commerce and capital flows and interchanges on which we both depend for survival. And so were we to cut those arteries, we would both be at risk. And at the same time, you know, we are giants. We have our own ambitions. We have our own way of thinking and our own needs. And that creates a tension. We have to learn how to balance within those kind of relationships rather than simply treating them as we might have treated the Soviet Union, which is a separate entity in a separate world. And we could just as well do without it as have it there. So this is a new kind of problem. And of course, the people in the NSC are considering it, because when you really get down to it, issues like how the U.S. is going to deal with China, which will certainly be the most important other power in the world during the remainder of this century, supplant even issues like terrorism in terms of importance to the United States' long-term health and growth and security.
Mm-hmm. But China presents a problem with an administration. There's an interesting quote you get from Brent Scowcroft, the model former NSC advisor, and that is this idea that if you embrace an idealized foreign policy, as this president has, forthcoming and forward-looking views of democracy, if you embrace those ideas, when you get down to pragmatic issues like China or Pakistan, you run into a lot of trouble.
Well, that's right. I mean, if you somehow think that what you're doing is for absolute good, then you start getting into ends justifies the means thinking, and that's a problem. But also ideology is a kind of gives you policy handcuffs, and you end up limiting your choices about how to handle things. China is an interesting example of this. If what you're doing is promoting democracy above all else, and China is less on the democracy scale than Taiwan, you might come to the conclusion that a number of neocons have, that in the event that there were a threat to Taiwan, the United States must naturally and immediately go to Taiwan's defense. And in fact, I think that's what the U.S. would do, to go back to the caller's question, if Taiwan were ever threatened. And that kind of puts the lie to the notion of the one China policy, which has been kind of a matter of theology for U.S. foreign policy for the past three decades.
Since Henry Kissinger.
But the question is that ultimately what's in the U.S. interest? And is democracy the only measure that we ought to be using to judge what is in our interests? And are there other kinds of freedoms or other kinds of national interests, economic interests, or simply regional security interests, which also have to be factored in? And that's why the traditionalist view of balancing all the factors runs into trouble with the transformationalist view, which is much more ideologically driven.
David Rothkopf's book is Running the World, the Inside Story of the National Security Council and the Architects of American Power. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Mike. Mike calling from San Marcos in Texas.
Hi. Yes, great topic. Hey, I had a question. If you view the shadow NSC as similar to the Group B or Plan B with the CIA in the late 70s, and, for example, the manipulation of intelligence.
Just to remind people that back in the 70s, this was a group of people largely around Senator Scoop Jackson's office who criticized the CIA, they thought, for being underestimating the power of the Soviet Union, and initiated another study, an alternative study called Team B. I think I got that right, David Rothkopf.
Yeah, I understand the origin of the question. I think that the reality is that there have always been sort of these shadow NSCs. There have always been informal groups that presidents have turned to in order to provide them with the trusted advice of people who they feel don't have the same kind of political agendas or bureaucratic agendas of others in the government. And I think that, it gets to a core debate that we're having right now about picking and choosing between intelligence sources. It's always done. The notion that somehow the Bush administration is the first in history to selectively listen to what it was getting from the intelligence community is just simply doesn't bear out. And it happened in the Clinton administration. It's happened in administrations in the past. And in fact, I was talking to Andrew Goodpaster, who was a top aide to General Eisenhower, recently died, a remarkable man. And he said, this debate about intelligence in the United States and this kind of notion of the perfectibility of intelligence is something Eisenhower would have had no patience for, because he lived through it in World War II. He got bad intelligence reports that said nothing's going on here in Belgium, and 2 weeks later, the Battle of the Bulge broke out. And, he realized that it was simply one of the tools that you have, and that you have to be selective with it. And the issue is really, do you have people who are being selective in the right ways, or are they using that selective process in order to support political objectives, which is clearly the wrong way?
Mike?
Yes, thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Thanks a lot. You're
appreciate
on good
it. Day. Okay, you too. As you look ahead, one of the key issues within the National Security Council has been its growth, and it was in the era of Henry Kissinger that it emerged really as a rival to the State Department.
Right, and I think that was true, not just because of the aspirations of Kissinger, but really because of the personality peculiarities of Nixon. Nixon didn't really want to deal with large groups of people. He had a deep, innate distrust of the State Department. He expressed that from day one and essentially decided that he was going to deal with Henry and Henry was going to deal with the rest of the community. Of course, Henry embraced this opportunity.
Sure.
Ultimately, not only was national security advisor, but was the only person who was, for a time, both national security advisor and secretary of state. But, you know, I think that the subsequent maintenance of the role of the National Security Advisor as a particularly central one has been affected by other things. The reality is today we live in very tight news cycles. Decisions need to be made close to the president and can't fan out in the bureaucracy and back quickly, so they end up happening in the White House. Because of the media, things get coverage and thus have political resonance that they didn't before there were 24-hour news channels. And so those decisions people want to get taken in the White House. The president needs to use all the different elements of the diplomatic and economic and intelligence and military toolbox, and those only exist within the NSC. So for a lot of secular reasons, the NSC has gradually increased in importance relative to the other agencies.
We're talking with David Rothkopf, Running the World, The Inside Story of the National Security Council and the Architects of American Power is his new book. We'll finish up our conversation after a short break. We'll also look at Time Magazine's decision to turn over a reporter's notes to the courts in the Valerie Plame case. I'm Neil Cohn, and it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now, we're continuing our discussion on the history and perhaps the future of the National Security Council. Our guest is David Rothkopf, former NSC insider and author of a book, Tracing the Council's History. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, TOTN at NPR.org. Let's get another caller on the line, and Ed is with us. Ed, calling from Panama City, Florida.
Yes, thank you. I look forward to reading the book. I wonder if you could comment on the relative roles of the DCI, the Director of Central Intelligence, and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, whom I believe are both statutory members, and of the Attorney General in the Reagan administration, who was a participating member but has not typically been the case in other administrations, and I'll listen offline.
Thanks, Ed.
Thank you.
Well, the president's allowed to put whomever he wants into the NSC mix, and Reagan did so with Meese because of the fact that he was a close advisor and one on whom he had depended for a long time, even when he was governor of California. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs and the director of Central Intelligence were both in the National Security Act of 1947 named as participants in the meetings, but they were not principals. They were consultants to the NSC, and they've continued in that role for a long time. Now, this actually just changed in the past month when it was designated that the Director of National Intelligence, who's supplanted the Director of Central Intelligence atop the intelligence structure, is now the guy who's going to be in these meetings as the advisor. I think there's an interesting commentary there, because if you go back and you read the National Security Act of 1947, you see that the Director of Central Intelligence was given the job of coordinating the intelligence flows from all the different intelligence apparatus in the United States government, which is the job that the Director of National Intelligence now has. And essentially what happened was it didn't work. And so we've reverted to, you know, the classic government solution, which is let's add another layer of bureaucracy with the exact same mission. In this case, we're giving the guy 1,000 members of his staff to help facilitate communication. Now, in what business would you add a layer of management and 1,000 people in order to facilitate better communication? So, you know, it's interesting to me, because you go back to this kind of dry, dusty document, the National Security Act of 1947, and you find that the vision they have of how this apparatus should work, domestic and foreign policy side by side, centralized coordination of intelligence flowing up in support of the policy process, was exactly what we think we want today. But we've built a giant and ever-expanding bureaucracy in order to try to achieve those things, when maybe simplification might actually be the better way to go.
Before the break, we were talking about Henry Kissinger, who, of course, was a national security advisor and provided a lot of charisma and glamour in that job, a lot of controversy as well. He, of course, later became then Secretary of State. We have now had another national security advisor make the same migration. What do you think is going to be the effect on that eternal turf war between the NSC and the State Department?
Well, I think we're actually going to see a ceasefire in that turf war over the course of the next couple of years, because Condoleezza Rice, who I think was kind of constrained in her role as National Security Advisor, because she was called upon to be such a close advisor to the president that she was really limited in how effective she could be in the honest broker role, is now really empowered as a Secretary of State, because everybody in the world knows her to be close to the president, to be able to speak to and for the president. And that's a benefit that Colin Powell didn't have in the office. So she is really an ascendant figure in this mix. Stephen Hadley was her deputy and is now the national security advisor. 6 months ago, if you'd gone to the website of the White House and clicked on NSC, I don't know why you would have, but had you done that, you would have seen the picture of national security advisor Condoleezza Rice. A month ago, you would have seen the picture of National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley and Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. They are still a team. He is still going over sometimes even to have meetings in the State Department, which is kind of unprecedented in this relationship. And so she has consolidated a block of power in this inner circle that I think is going to have her be not only a more influential figure during the remainder of the Bush administration, but I think a more effective Secretary of State than she had been as National Security Advisor.
You say that Condoleezza Rice will be changed more by the State Department than she will change it.
Well, this happens to, you know, virtually everybody who moves into a big bureaucracy in Washington. And there's a kind of a Washington maxim that I come back to several times in the book, and that is that where you sit is where you stand. In other words, if you are over in Foggy Bottom running the State Department, pretty soon you start being changed by State Department views and you start sounding like a Secretary of State. And if you're sitting at the White House down the hall from the president, where everything is driven by politics and loyalty to the president, it sounds somewhat different. Now, I'm not saying Condoleezza Rice is going to sort of dilute her loyalty to the president, because I think that's fundamental to her. But I do think that a lot of the initiatives of the State Department are soon going to be seen by her as her initiatives. And she's going to soon start speaking for the staff that's prepared them, the teams that are in the field. And that's going to give a different cast and a different perspective to the views that she offers in these inner councils.
David Rothkopf, thanks very much for being with us today.
A real pleasure. Thank you for having me.
David Rothkopf, chairman and CEO of the Rothkopf Group, and he's also the author of Running the World, the Inside Story of the National Security Council and the Architects of American Power. He joined us from NPR's offices in San Francisco.